Hello, this is Françoise Mathieu, and this is Webinar 12, Mapping Out an Action Plan at Home and at Work. If you have successfully listened to all 12 of these webinars, congratulations, and I hope that you found them helpful. And as you will have seen, there's a lot of resources that we've shared on the website, lots of added pieces, you know, depending on what direction you want to go with this. And I hope that some of these elements spoke to you, because there's as many personalities and styles and preferences and challenges as there are people. What we found with these workshops is that there's certain directions that some of us need to focus on more than others. So, for example, it might be, I certainly know that at a certain stage in my life when I had two very young children and some caregiver roles with some sick elder relatives, I had a much different challenge in terms of managing my time and energy than I may have right now. There were other times in my career where what I really needed more than anything was more training, because there are certain types of cases I was working with that were more challenging. So, I mean, I think that there's no one size fits all. And I think that if you have listened to the webinars, I think that's pretty clear. So what I wanted to do today, this will be probably a little bit shorter. I just wanted to add one more piece in terms of some interesting research that's been done, and then quickly go over what has been discussed during these last 11 webinars before this one, and invite you to create a bit of an action plan to decide where you're going to begin and what you're going to focus on. Naomi Raymond is a physician who has worked in cancer care for many years, and she wrote a wonderful book in 1996 called Kitchen Table Wisdom. And in it, she has this quote that I love, and it says, "The expectation that we can be immersed in suffering and loss daily and not be touched by it is as unrealistic as expecting to be able to walk through water without getting wet." And she continued by saying, "We burn out not because we don't care, but because we have lost the ability to deal with all the demands, and then we are no longer able to care." And so we can't do these very challenging works, and special ed in particular, working with kids with complex issues, if you have absolutely been unaffected by it. You know, I find that almost unbelievable, although we know that some folks just have better strategies than others, or just their personality profile. They're just less affected by it. I mean, there's some really interesting research, and I'm going to tell you about that in a minute. So go back to our good old balance map, and as you know, if you listen to the different webinars, we focus on a variety of factors, such as simplifying certain aspects of our lives so things are a little bit less stressful so that we're not running on adrenaline. We've talked about our physical health and wellness. We've talked about what are ways that we can bring some stress relief to our days so that our days don't end with us collapsing into bed and just starting over the next day. We need to restore. We need to rebuild. And even if that's not very long, so maybe you have a lot of caregiver demands at home, even if you get 15 minutes by yourself to read your favorite magazine, we need to have some ways to have some stress relief. We talked about how we react to change. We talked about the importance of social support, the importance of having stimulating and engaging work and or hobbies. We also talked about how to manage trauma exposure, borrowing the term trauma stewardship from Laura Vandenut-Lipsky. We had a whole conversation about managing occupational stress and resentment. And giving back really refers to finding ways to be involved. It doesn't mean you need to volunteer in some huge advocacy group on top of the job that you do, but there's lots of ways to give back to our community. And one of them is just in our daily lives, in our workplace, to make some decisions about kindness, you know, helping, going the extra mile for someone when they're going through a rough time. And I'm kind of talking about our colleagues here. There's lots of ways to give back that don't necessarily mean more time and energy. And in fact, they might be quite fulfilling things that we do. So I want to tell you about a really interesting study that was done by a colleague of mine called Richard Harrison and Marv Westwood. And they are at the University of British Columbia, and in, I believe it's 2009, let me just take a look here, 2009, Richard, it was actually part of his PhD thesis, did a really interesting study, and it's got a big, long title, but I'll tell you what it actually was about. So the title is Preventing Vicarious Traumatization, of mental health therapists identifying protective practices. So in simpler terms, what is that study about? Richard was very interested in studying highly resilient practitioners. Who are the folks that seem to really thrive and do well in spite of some very challenging work situations? I had the privilege of meeting someone like that last week. I was on my way up to Kenora, so flying to Winnipeg, then drive to Kenora. And I was at the airport, and I met this older woman who clearly was a nurse. I don't know what, why. Nurses, I just know who nurses are. Maybe you do too. And we started talking. And she said she was 73 years old, and she still works full-time as a nurse. And she was on her way to Northern Ontario to work in, or no, that's not true. She was on her way to Nunavut. And she was going to work in a medical clinic for 3.5 months all summer. And I said to her, you clearly love your job. And she said, yep, been a nurse 50 years, loved every minute of it. Now, the more we talked, because I was, of course, fascinated by this, she said she'd had a rough childhood, she'd had a divorce. Like, this woman has not had, you know, this pristine, perfect life. But she also somehow, and if I had more time, I'd want to bring her in the lab and figure out, what is it that has kept this woman so healthy and positive? And, you know, she was very respectful of First Nations communities that she works with. Like, she was just amazing. So this is basically what Richard Harrison wanted to do when he studied these highly resilient clinicians. And what he did is he got therapists that were peer nominated. So that means that he asked therapists in Vancouver to vote, you know what I'm saying, like to vote for basically the best clinicians, the best ones, what, the ones that everyone says are the most compassionate, patient, you know, therapists in the community. And then he interviewed them and he came up with some really interesting findings about what is it that those folks do to stay healthy and well, and what could we learn from them? So there were several factors. Some of them I've talked about already, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on them, but some of his key findings were that all of them said the social support was essential. Now, some of them worked in small private offices, so they did not necessarily have social support in the workplace. And so what they had done is they had created their own peer support, you know, informal or formal ways to have some debriefing or supervision. They also talked about the importance of social support in their personal lives. The second finding, which I found very interesting and certainly consistent with my own professional experience, is a lot of them enjoyed variation or variety in their roles. So they liked having diversity. Now, some of you, if you work in busy schools, you're like, oh, I have lots of that, maybe too much of it. But, you know, to give you an example from my field, I had a friend who at some point was exclusively working with anxious people. And she found that to be pretty exhausting. But then, you know, when she trained and got some additional skills as a couples therapist and maybe working also with folks who had, you know, career-related challenges, she was able to balance her caseload a little bit more. Now, I'm well aware that in the schools, we don't necessarily have that control. So I want to invite you to think about what are ways that you have obtained diversity in your jobs? And would you agree that that's been a way to restore ourselves a little bit? The next one I really love, and it's called mindfulness, that some of you are very familiar with that so far. You've heard about mindfulness, but it's also a term that has been referred to as dual awareness. So let me explain what that is. Dual awareness is being able to be present in the room to what's going on right now, but also be able to check in with ourselves about how we are feeling about what's happening. So it's kind of like making sure that your heart and your brain are connected and talking to each other. Babette Rothschild, who's an expert in the field and has written a great book called Help for the Helper, has talked about that. Dual awareness is you are sitting in a classroom or you're standing up and there's a parent, let's pretend, we'll take a parent as an example. A parent is yelling at you or is very upset. You can absolutely be there and listen to them, but at the same time, you can kind of look in yourself and notice, what's my body temperature like? How am I feeling right now? And so that's a way of navigating between not getting kind of completely swallowed into what's going on, but being able to stay grounded. And that's actually what mindfulness meditation practices are about. It's about they're not about checking out and, you know, being completely removed from the world. They're about the ability to be attuned to how we are emotionally and physically feeling while we're also involved in talking to someone else or being engaged, you know, in a more heated kind of conversation. So that's dual awareness, simply explained. Other things that they found from these award-winning clinicians were lots of good self-care. A lot of them also had optimism. Now, it's tough because optimism, I don't know a lot about, I haven't looked at the research recently, but I don't know if you can teach optimism. I think that some of us are just naturally more positive than others. I think it's a disposition thing, a personality thing. I remember years ago going on a bike trip with my best friend, and we foolishly thought that we could bicycle in the Madeline Islands. If you don't know where the Madeline Islands are, they're, you know, they're in the Maritimes, they're close to PEI. It's one of the windiest places in Canada. And so biking there was a terrible mistake. We couldn't even move, you know. And I remember one day she was raging. She was in such a bad mood. And I remember saying to her, we're on our way somewhere. And there was a hill, you know, kind of at a fork in the road. And I remember saying to her, at least we don't have to go up that hill. And she said she almost punched me that day. I'm a naturally optimistic person. I don't know why. Maybe it's just personality. It's certainly, you know, I've had my fair share of disappointments and difficult things in my life, but I've just always been like that. So they found that optimism was a very protective factor. Another one, of course, are clear boundaries, which is essential. And I've had that conversation in a prior webinar as well. We also found, so Richard Harrison coined a term that I just think it's such a beautiful word. He called it exquisite empathy. And what exquisite empathy refers to is being able to care just the right amount. What is the sweet spot between caring too much and not caring at all? And if you know the secret to that, you let me know, because that's basically all I do. My entire job is trying to teach people that exact sweet spot between not caring at all and caring too much. And can we agree that we're all going to go back and forth and have good days and bad days? And that's just completely normal. So it's not about perfection all the time. It's just about being able to somehow have a really healthy baseline as we go up and down. The other thing they found from these clinicians was having a life outside of work was really protective, and feeling competent and good at what they do. And this is one that actually goes back to kind of workplace challenges that some of you are very experienced and have dealt with lots of complex cases in the past, and some of you may be quite new, and maybe you haven't had as much training. And we found that feeling competent and confident, of course, if we're feeling competent and confident, we are less stressed because we know what we need to do. An example I could give you is, as I have worked as a crisis counselor for many years, you can imagine that the very first suicidal student that I had to go see, I was stressed out. I was stressed out of my mind. I didn't want to mess this up. I didn't know what I was walking into. I didn't have a lot of experience. And I'm not saying that that's no big deal anymore. Like, I'm not eating my snack while doing it, but I've done so many that that's part of an area for me where I have confidence and competence. So there are times where having access to education and training can be very good for that. Even though there are times where some of our workplaces don't offer as much as they should or that we'd like them to. And this is where, you know, accessing web-based training can be really great. Now, my only concern sometimes is if I talk to a kind of really frustrated staff member and they'll say to me, I'm not going to take that course. I'm not forced to. And I'm like, oh, I respect that. But I mean, honestly, the more we learn, the more we can also, the more we learn, the more we can protect ourselves, right? So that's what I have found, is that I have gone to tons of workshops on trauma. And, you know, I don't have a boss. I'm self-employed and I had to pay for it myself. And it has really saved my career and my sanity. And so I think sometimes we also have to look at, you know, who pays the price if we don't learn the skills, if we don't do the voluntary or extra training. And sometimes the training is not that great, and that's okay. We don't have to go to everything. And sometimes we might find a resource that's really a game changer. And, you know, if it ends up being making me a better parent, better spouse, better member of society, and a better professional, then I'm always in favor of those things. So as Richard Harrison said, you know, we all need to have a life. And I'm saying that half jokingly, but I think that there are times where we get so busy with this stuff. And as I mentioned in a prior webinar, research has shown that some of us start ramping up our stress hormones a day before we go back to work, or more, days before we return to work. So on a weekend, you know, by Sunday morning, do you start getting stressed about it? And also that we get so wrapped up in our jobs because they're so demanding that we forget to just enjoy some basic things in life. I know that I'm guilty of that. I work a lot, and it's self-imposed, by the way. As I said, I'm my own boss. And I have a hard time, you know, even if I'm home, I like to get stuff done. And sometimes I wear myself out. So it's a good reminder for me. There are times where I just need to pause and go and do things that I enjoy with my family, for example. So here's a picture of my son who just turned 18, cutie patootie, and he loves fishing. And I remember last year we got up, you know, super early. That's the picture on the left. And we went and we didn't catch anything. Actually, it was not one of those days. But you know what? He had such a good time. And I just sometimes have to remind myself that what matters the most is spending time with him. And when he wants to hang out, which is, of course, more and more rare because he's 18 years old, I grab those 5, 10, 15 minutes he gives me and I put my phone down, I turn off my computer and I just focus on him. You know, this is a picture of my garden from last year. Now, you may not be into gardening, it's fine. And I'm not a very good gardener, but I don't know why when the peonies come out like kind of late May, early June, I just go bananas. I love those crazy flowers. I don't know why. They make me so happy. I make my whole family come outside and look at every single one of them. They just fill me with joy. And I think there are times where we forget to just reconnect with things that bring us joy. I have a friend who's involved in community theater. Now, for some of you, you work with kids all day, so you might not think that that's a relaxing thing to do, which I respect. So what are some of those things? This is a picture I took of a sunset. I was doing some training and we took an extra few minutes after and went on a little hike. And I mean, look at that picture. And I think sometimes we forget even what season it is out there. So just an invitation to reconnect with those things. Dr. Les Greenberg, who's a wonderful psychologist based in Toronto, used to always say, dig where the ground is soft. So don't focus on the things, as we've been doing these workshops, don't focus on the things that are unmovable and unchangeable. You know, if you have a really complex situation at work and you cannot imagine changing one single thing, well, then don't focus on that. Where can you begin? So here's a quick overview of what we discussed. As you will recall, we discussed the complex stress model and how our workplaces are very unique because in addition to systemic workplace stress, we are exposed to trauma in a variety of ways and it has an impact on us. We went through the Venn diagram where we invited you to look at all the different elements to try and isolate what are the real salient factors for you, and that becomes your roadmap to what to focus on and what you need to work on and where you're doing well. We talked about your warning signs and the big three, physical, emotional, and behavioral warning signs. We did the what's on your plate activity to try and identify what are the areas that you're going to start with. We talked about the hot walk and talk. When you're feeling stressed, find someone to talk to, but also drink some water and walk it off so you can process your stress hormones. We had a whole webinar on processing and resetting after exposure to a difficult story. We talked about the adverse childhood experiences study and how we found that 4 or more of these ACEs had significant negative health outcomes and behavioral and influenced behavioral decisions and change as well. We talked about the window of tolerance framework and how what happens when we get bumped out into hyperarousal mode or hypoarousal mode and how we can widen that window. We talked a lot about stress at work and how to develop positive alliances. And I invited you to think about how to create or restore your social supports at home as well. Finally, we talked about the zone of control and the zone of influence. And that's basically, in a nutshell, all the different elements that we discussed in this webinar. I want to conclude by inviting you to think about a couple of things. My friend Laura, her book Trauma Stewardship is full of New Yorker cartoons, and she shows this one. As you see, it says, "Lassie, get help." So she does. I find that a lot of people avoid or delay going to get some mental health services until they're in crisis. And of course, it's fine if you're in crisis, by all means, go. But, you know, you don't need to be in crisis to go and see a good therapist. And shop around. If you don't like the first person you see, try someone else. There's a lot of good clinicians out there, but there's also people who may not be a good fit for you. And, you know, I think that what's at stake and why I feel so strongly about the work that I do is that remaining compassionate and healthy in these challenging environments matters so much. It matters for us in our family, in our own lives, in our family and friends, how we work with folks, with each other, how we work as a society, and of course, for us professionally as well. So as we wrap up, I'm going to invite you to think about what is a 1% change, a micro movement that you could make so that this entire series, if you did listen to them, was worth it for you. I love this slide. It says procrastination. I'll find a picture for it later. What's something you could do today? Reach out to someone, get an accountability partner, read one resource. What's a micro movement you can make? I'm going to finish by telling a quick story that some of you know about because it's been around for a long time, and it's called the Starfish Story. And it's a parable. I'm not even sure which from originally. I've heard it in so many places. And it connects, it's kind of a bookend to what I talked about at the beginning with my sister going in the north. And here's how the story goes. It's a beach. There's a beach. And there's about a million starfish that have landed on the beach. And little kid is there. And he gets to the beach and he starts throwing the starfish one at a time back in the water. One, two, three, saving the starfish from drying out. This old man comes to him and he says, "Why bother? There's a million starfish on this beach. You will never save them all." And the little boy keeps on picking one up at a time and throwing them back in. And he says to the man, "It matters to this one, throw it in, and this one, and this one, and this one." And the truth is that that is the only way I know how to measure success in these challenging work environments that we all evolve in, is measuring it by one kid at a time, one success at a time, even one good day at a time with these really challenging situations that we work with. It's what keeps me going, and hopefully you too. I hope you find these useful as ever. If you ever have questions, please reach out to us. And if you want more resources, we've provided a whole host of them. And I truly hope that in the very important work that you do, that this webinar series was helpful to you. I wish you all the best, and I'll see you at some other time. Thanks.